Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here. It's glad to be here, too. Long time no see. It's been a while. I've had a long slew of challenges for myself, starting with a lot of teeth problems. I don't know if I was bitching about any of this stuff last time I talked to you, but in the last couple months, I've had a tooth pulled, and like I wasn't able to eat. And it was really difficult to talk, like as far as painful in some instances. Like the first tooth that broke off was cutting the back of my mouth and my tongue to the point that I couldn't even swallow. And so I just was in this fight or flight response for such a minute that I kind of put a lot of projects down on the back burner, all the way from my extractions to this. And like, I guess I would like to apologize right on the nose for not saying anything about it or mentioning what was going on or having at least an episode saying that I'd be back in a while. But I'm starting to feel more myself again, and I'm feeling more competent in my daily tasks. And I want to start making things again. And I just recently finished an artistic project last week, and that was a tremendous boon, and I just miss doing this, and so I'd like to get back into it, and I'm just glad that you're still here, and I'm glad that we can be back in the space together. So this week we're gonna be talking about a lot of cool shit. Not really sure what I'm gonna talk about yet, but there's a little bit of confidence that words will come out, so let's get on into it. So what am I doing here? What is purpose? Purpose is a unique question to be asked to each and every one of us. And there's different answers depending on who's asking. But I would say that my purpose stands on 2 feet here on this show. And it's two aspects of existence that I consider often and I try to practice in some way, shape, or form. And it's very vague and general when I say practice because there's no goals here. There's no orientation in space. But I would say, first and foremost, I am openly investigating in myself and in the world what love is. And not just the word love, you know, but what's the feeling behind interconnectedness in our societies and in our nature. There's these unspoken bonds that hold our atoms together and similarly hold ecosystems together and allow different plants and animals to eat each other in balanced ways. And whilst violence in instances can seem terrifying in some moments, there's always some sort of hidden agenda behind everything. And I'm not speaking about God or some sort of watchmaker that's pulling the strings. Even if that agenda is purely just falling apart and heading towards decomposition, because that's also an aspect of life. And what brings me back from being morbidly opposed to this action is this bond, this reason, this will to live, as opposed to Nietzsche's will to power. As a parent, it comes from openly confronting all the challenges associated with such an act and putting oneself wholly into that relationship. And I find it very compelling. And that's just one aspect of how I think about love, you know. But it also feels fantastic to be part of a group of somethings. And that's kind of what I'm perpetually trying to teach my son, is how individually we can want a lot of things, but we're so much stronger when we are in these composite paintings of being, where everybody's working together or working side by side. And so love is very important. It's what brings us out of too much selfishness and considering too much I-ness. Now, the other sort of leg that I stand upon is this idea of curiosity. And curiosity is actively looking towards the world, you know, not just as something out there, but finding our way to express something upon it. Art is a curious expression of our humanity, of our personality. And I spend a lot of time looking at and considering art. And it makes me feel outside of myself for a second when I see somebody else's expression that is so expressionate. I don't know if that's a word, but I feel like there's a curiosity in ideas as well, and forming meaning systems for ourselves and finding how and where and when we want to live the lives that we do. And I feel that in living these lives, this is a creative, expressive, curious act. And we're not automatons, we're not gears in the machine. I think that at any point in time, any human being can go outside the box and make their own meaning system. And in a way, I see that incredibly radical, a revolutionary of sorts. And so curiosity and love are the two facets that I find so compelling, but there's many more. And yet again, these are just words. All we're ever doing is playing with words and idea forms, and as they precipitate out of thought, and thought seeds, new ideas and new thoughts. And it's like we're gardening up in our minds and in our lives, because everything is a product of mind, at least according to the Buddha. So, yeah, I think I've rambled on long enough, but I appreciate you letting me remind myself of what I'm doing. It might take me a little bit to get into a good flow again, but I'm just so grateful to be feeling, you know, just stronger, you know. I hope that you can find some way to feel stronger too. We all have struggles. We all have our challenges. But we can also persevere. And luckily, you know, if it's medical or stuff, we live in at least most of the world lives very close to some sort of healthcare system. And it's like magic that they can fix us the way they do, even if it's really expensive. Well, anyways, what I want to talk about today is this cool book. It's called The Spectrum of Consciousness by Ken Wilber. And I think I was mentioning it a little bit months ago. It's a long one, so I'm still in it. But it was published by the Theosophical Society, or Theosophical Publishing House. I don't know. But Theosophy was co-created by Madame Blavatsky, which I feel I've mentioned before. And she was Ukrainian and was kind of a wackadoodle, free-spirited person who, you know, completely traveled the world back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, all the way through South America and probably through like places like India. And she collected all these different meaning systems, these different philosophies, these different religions. She was doing something very similar to what I was doing, but she started this crazy, and it was mishandled and misappropriated towards very many cultish sort of settings after her and during her reign. But I don't remember what the other creator of it was, but it goes as far as being as wackadoodle as aliens. And, you know, like she talked about these things called like Lemurians, and they would, these like spirits that lived in the mountains. And this is like the stuff that seeded Scientology and the very fertile landscape that was the spiritualism and occultism of the 1900s. And I'm shocked that it's not spoken about more, you know. And then all of a sudden you flash forward and you have the satanic panic of the 80s. Like, I just find it so compelling when it comes to culture. But anyways, Ken Wilber's writing this book called The Spectrum of Consciousness. And his theory basically is that reality, the holistic whole, which this is such a hard subject for me to even wrap my head around. It's hard for me to conceive, and I have no idea how to really talk about it. And that's why I didn't even want to talk about it, but I still feel compelled to try. But within Buddhism, you have mind, and everything is a product of mind. And within Taoism, you have non-duality, wu-wei, And non-dualism is the opposition of dualism, where dualism is, you know, two things, but it could be a multiplicitous amount of dissections into parts. And the way we rationalize, we look around, even in my room, I could pick out 1,000 different things that are in my room that all collectively could still be called my room. But underneath, like, the intellect, underneath the perceiver, what William James called a perception, you know, before the percept is precipitated, before the thing is seen, behind that there is this supposed awareness in some schools of thought of the thing before it is. And Kant had his pneuma, which pneuma is reality as it is, and then there's the phenomena, which is what we perceive, and we have like these rose-colored glasses built of concepts, and then whenever we perceive anything, it has to go through the filter of our concepts, which is bled in by our memories and our opinions of things and our expectations of things, and all of a sudden the pneuma has mutated into a very strange phenomena far apart from what it is. Plato had his ideal world of forms, where you have a lot of different types of trees or chairs or mirrors or whatever, dogs, but there's this ideal form of what the dog is, capital D or capital G, if you want to switch the letters around and consider a god. But what's compelling about this thing, mind, which for now I'm going to start calling the universe, you know, and if it's a multiverse, then we're considering all of them. But it's hard to think about what holism is, what the whole. Like, it's so challenging to think about everything. Our brains are so bad at understanding large numbers. And we have like a name that's like astronomically large when they get like too huge. So consider this little thought. Brain picture thingy. So I was reading my quantum book that I found very interesting and exciting. And there's this metaphor about how many hydrogen atoms can fit into like a tablespoon. Like if you had a tablespoon of hydrogen atoms, like somehow pure hydrogen, I don't know what that would even look like. But apparently, if you were to remove one piece of hydrogen, like one atom from that pile in your spoon, every second, it would take the entire known history of the universe, all 13.6 supposed billion years that have passed, twice. So closer to 28 billion years of seconds to remove every hydrogen atom from that tablespoon. That's how ridiculously small and tiny these things are. And here's another one just to think about. So within that hydrogen atom, if the nucleus, the little lone proton pair that's sitting in the middle of this floating supposed object thingy, and if that was the size of a sports stadium, then the nucleus itself would be the size of an apple sitting on the inside of the sports stadium. The lone electron that makes up its shell and does all of its physical properties and interacts with everything to make molecules in your physical form is the size of a grain of rice floating haphazardly, randomly around this gigantic sports stadium. Like, most atoms themselves are 99.9999% empty space, meaning so are we and everything else that we know. And not even to consider what the fuck black dark matter is or whatever, you know? So when it comes to thinking about large numbers and thinking about how big everything is, we're poorly suited intellectually to even come close to understanding this. I know I am. That's where I'm speaking from, is from the fact that I can't understand this. So I'm going to go grab this book just so I have a good reference. I'll be right back.
Hello. Thank you for your patience. So I'm holding this book to this really cool graph that I found very interesting and I think holds a lot of these different mishmash of schools of thought into a really composite picture when we're thinking about scientism and its efforts at meaning and relating things together. And we think about religion and its meaning systems and relating spiritual is stuff together. And then you have philosophies, and then you have all the stuff in between, and mysticism, and like everything points towards this kind of interconnectedness that I spoke about in my diatribe about love. But what really binds everything together are these distinctions. That's kind of how we think about, and that's how we separate ourselves from the whole. And one more thing about it, like, consider what a boundary is. Like, imagine you have a whiteboard and you draw a circle on that whiteboard. That's not whole, because which part of the depiction is it? Is it the inside and the outside, or the outside of the whiteboard? Like, whenever there's an edge or a boundary, we're still firmly in this idea of distinction. And for now, I want to consider distinction itself and this reasonableness that makes us powerhouses empirically on this planet. But imagine how these distinctions and this pair of scissors makes cuts. So according to this guy, the first cut would be the degree of subject and object. So for the whiteboard picture with the circle on it, the subject would be the inside looking at the outside. There's a space between the two things. And at that point, you're firmly dualized. So that's the first degree of separation. When you have a subject and an object, the subject can be considered life and the object can be considered not life. And this is where you have the second degree, the second distinction, the cut of life and death. And then comes the arguments of white and black, of good and bad. Is life to be considered more important than death? Is death to be considered as important as life? Within the totality of wholeness, outside of the distinction, they're supposedly the same thing. Within this consideration, if you think of it as being on one side of the spectrum, everything, and on the other side of the spectrum, one independent thing. And how do you cut those things up? And he would argue that we do it with our brains, with our minds. And so from these two cuts, you end up going from the universal mind to the existential. And this is kind of where all my bullshit that I've talked about with Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre and the existentialism of being and nothingness. And go back in time, go to those old episodes if you want to hear more about that stuff. I've talked about it a lot. But that's kind of their realm that they're considering, is these existential considerations of what reality is. And between the two are these bands of information that go back and forth between universal thinking and between existential thinking. He calls these the transpersonal bands. And like, I have such a poor conceptualization of this, of even being able to think about it. And philosophically, I'm such an infant, and I'm still trying to figure out what this would even mean to me. And like, I'm not sure if a lot of my experiences ever reflect any of these things that we're talking about. Like, existential, perhaps, because I felt the disillusionment of ego and thought, and that can be very scary. And a lot of those instances that I've experienced, I've talked about in the past, being chemically based, due to dimethyltryptamine or psilocybin or LSD. But even when I've gone to these places, it's really hard to bring anything back. You know, so there's not even really memories there. There's just a knowledge of knowing that I've seen it dissolve. And there's power in that, honestly. But yeah, well, let's get into more stuff that I would know more of. So at this point, we're firmly at the split where we have organism and environment. The third degree of cut is where you cut the organism in half. And this cut turns into the ego, the psyche, and the soma, the body. And at this level, in between the existential and the ego, are biosocial bands. And this one's really easy to think about, because consider workforces, consider society as a whole. Consider the social contract that we all agree to when we respect one another. You know, we all know how to drive on roads and road rules. And these are implied knowledge bits that we all adhere to. These are examples of the biosocial band, because organismically, we're considering all of life, not just the individual pieces. You know, so once we have an individual piece, that comes with the birth of the ego. That comes with the birth of the psyche. That comes with the birth of the I sense, of that little thought inside my head that has a basis for who he thinks he is. Now, the next cut is where we cut the ego in half. We have a total ego at this point. That would be a very saintly ego, one who knows himself in all totality, or herself. But now we're going to cut it again. This is the fourth degree of distinction cuts away from the universal wholeness, according to this guy. And now we have the persona, which is the agreed upon aspects that we like about ourselves, that we keep in mind, like when we consider like the ideal aspects. When somebody asks you who you are, what you respond, that's persona. And then there's all the things that we don't like, the aspects of ourselves that we have decided to walk away. And within, you know, the therapeutic model of internal family systems, these are the outcasts, the parts that we lock in doors, the ones that we ground and we chastise and we decide that aren't who we are. See, this is a cut, a distinction of pushing away pieces of that thing. And this, they call it the shadow, which of course correlates heavily with the Jungian sense of what the shadow is. But clerically at that point, that's where I'm at most of the time right now in my life and in my work with myself, has been trying to unify my persona. You know, I'm trying to bring in these unconscious pieces that, because the thing about the shadow and the thing about the pieces that we've lost for such a long time is sometimes we forget that they even exist. We forget how to talk to them. We forget what they want. And it can be like an alien presence coming in when inevitably the pieces that we've locked up break out. Because the more pressure we put on not being something we are, the more things we put away into that unconscious prison, or the more pressure builds in that space. It's an infinite space in my mind, at least whenever I feel like I've traveled into that unconscious area. It's always felt immensely huge. Yet the unification of those two things is what I've been working on, and giving credence and giving voice to all aspects of my being and trying to make other people feel comfortable with being able to do that for themselves. I think that there's a lot of value in that too for me. Now, yet again, a lot of the experiences for me that severely broke me out of only seeing things intellectually, which I feel is always my curse, was because I always understood logic too well, to the point of cutting away empathy and the romantic ways of viewing the world. And it was definitely substances and psychedelics, primarily DMT, that shifted me so much towards seeing that there's other aspects of being. Like William James, I'm not going to quote him because I don't have him in front of me, but he roughly said, in paraphrase, that, you know, at all points in time, right outside of this way of perceiving the world, there's a bajillion other states of consciousness and ways of experiencing the world, all coexisting simultaneously. And with just a nudge, you could see the world dramatically different, and it's still the same world. Like, a lot of the cosmic shifts for me, especially my youth, were overindulgences of these serotonin drugs. And I was talking with a friend this morning about a lot of these ideas because I'm obsessed. And I told him, I was like, you know, I'm working a lot on learning what my unconscious is and learning the 99% of me that I don't hold during the daytime. And it's terrifying when I do hold it, but it's still part of this work. And every time I've gone in there, it's like I said, an immense space, like everything. It's like you go in and all of a sudden it flips. And a lot of my ideas of feeling like I experienced some universal mind or the collective unconscious of the universe or whatever the fuck you want to call it, has been through an intense desire to go inwards and knowing that dark aspect of me, the final distinction, the final cut that I did to myself at some point, you know? And every time I've gone inwards, it's opened up into everything. And it's like a circular vortex. And I feel like you can go round and round about over and over and over again. And I feel I've heard that mentioned in some Buddhist texts and for monks and shit. And it gives me some peace that maybe I'm getting closer to understanding this thing in a monastic sense. And I have faith that humans have been doing this for thousands of years. It's highly compelling and very exciting. Yeah, I mean, I'm still just an infant, a baby. But at least I still have 2/3 of my life left. And so that makes me feel like there's stuff to look forward to. So yeah, that's my little shtick for today. I wanted to describe that graph a little bit and talk about the base of this guy's ideas. Maybe I could find a good little bit where he's talking about something interesting. I'll be right back. All right. So this is from chapter 2 of Ken Wilber's book, Two Modes of Knowing. And I'm just going to read a little bit so you can kind of get a sense for his voice. And if you want to go look into it, I'm sure you can find this book somewhere. When the universe as a whole seeks to know itself through the medium of the human mind, some aspects of that universe must remain unknown. With the awakening of symbolic knowledge, there seems to arise a split in the universe between the knower and the known, the thinker and the thought, the subject and the object. And our innermost consciousness, as knower and investigator of the external world, ultimately escapes its own grasp and remains as the unknown, unshown, and ungraspable, much as your hand can grasp numerous objects, but never itself, or your eyes can see the world, but not itself. In the words of D.T. Suzuki, in the beginning, which is really no beginning, the will wants to know itself, and consciousness is awakened. And with the awakening of consciousness, the will is split in two. The one will, whole and complete in itself, is now at once actor and observer. Conflict is inevitable, for the actor now wants to be free from the limitations under which he has been obliged to put himself in his desire for consciousness. He has, in one sense, been enabled to see. But at the same time, there is something which he, as observer, cannot see. The physicist, Eddington, put it succinctly. Nature thus provides the knowledge of one half of the world will ensure ignorance of the other half. And G. Spencer Brown, in a most spectacular passage, explains. Let us then consider for a moment the world as described by the physicist. It consists of a number of fundamental particles which, if shot through their own space, appear as waves, and are thus the same laminated structure as pearls or onions. The other wave forms, called electromagnetic, which it is convenient, by Occam's razor, to consider as traveling through space with a standard velocity. All these appear bound by certain natural laws which indicate the form of their relationship. Now the physicist himself, who describes all this, is at his own account himself constructed of it. He is, in short, made up of a conglomeration of the very particles he describes, no more, no less, bound together by and obeying such general laws as he himself has managed to find and to record. Thus we cannot escape the fact that the world we know is constructed in order, and thus in such way as to be able to see itself. That is indeed amazing. Such a knife cannot cut itself. The universe cannot totally see itself as an object without totally mutilating itself. The attempt to know the universe as an object of knowledge is thus profoundly and inexorably contradictory. And the more it seems to succeed, the more it actually fails. The more the universe becomes false to itself. And yet, oddly enough, this type of dualistic knowledge, wherein the universe is severed unto object versus subject, as well as Western philosophy, theology, and science. For Western philosophy is, by and large, Greek philosophy, and Greek philosophy is the philosophy of dualism. Most of the great philosophical topics still debated today were created and molded by the philosophers of ancient Greece. These include the dualism. All right, I'm done. He just keeps going on with that for a while. But it's potent still. I like it. I don't think it's bullshit. Like I swore when I saw the label about it being a theosophical published book, I was sure that it was going to be full of wackadoodle nonsense. But I've honestly found a lot of the material very good. And a lot of its quotes, a lot of its quotations. That's a lot of what William James does too, is a lot of quotes, and then he'll kind of relate and then give his own opinion. That's not how I'm going to write when I decide to, but it helps me learn.
thank you for giving me your ear for this half hour. And I hope that something I said can be inspiring to you to go find your love and to find your curiosity in this life. And I'm glad that you came here to be with me, the Gingerbread Man, hang out, talk about some shit. All right. I'm going to go find Odin and we'll let him sign you off. And then I'll see you next week.
Hello, it's Asko and the Gingerbread Man.
Woo!
It's been such a long time since we did this.
Yes. You want to tell anybody anything new about what's going on in your life?
No.
He's doing really good in school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, how are you guys doing? It's been a long time. I'm pretty sure it's been 2 months since we got on.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Well, I'm glad to be back.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing this for me.
I'm glad to be back, too.
I love you, bud.
I love you.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.